This is the son of PCJ.
This is London. This is London.
The Voice of Russia World Service.
This is the Voice of America, Washington, D.C., signing on.
This is the Dutch World Broadcasting System in Hilversum, Holland, with a relay transmission via Bonaire in the Netherlands Antilles, directed from New Zealand.
This is Radio Prague, Czechoslovakia.
Ici Radio Canada. This is Canada.
Bonjour à vous si vous nous rejoignez sur Radio France Internationale. Il est 5h à Paris.
This is Radio Ukraine International.
This is the English program of Radio Deutsche Welle, Germany's international broadcasting service.
Media Network Plus, produced and presented by Paulette Macquarie and Keith Perron.
Well, hello friends and listeners. It's nice to have you join us again. Coming up on today's show, we're going to go inside a service of the BBC known as BBC Monitoring, that for over 60 years has provided breaking news from areas of the world that are difficult to get an inside look of what's really going on. We're also going to play James Bond. Yes, you heard me correct, that's right, James Bond. Now think of it, you're a spy, you have a notepad, a special ink-free pen, and a radio. And you're waiting for the latest message from Miss Moneypenny. We're going to look at a very odd spy number station. All this and much more, so stay tuned. Media Network Plus, high on content and low on frequency. First, here's Paulette with a look at some of the headlines from the world of media.
The Television New Zealand Charter has been abolished through a bill passed by New Zealand's Parliament. The charter encouraged TV New Zealand to show programs that reflect New Zealand's identity, in return receiving $15 million New Zealand dollars, about $12.66 million U.S. dollars, to produce shows that would not be commercially viable. The Labour Party implemented the charter in 2003, but the New Zealand government announced in 2009 that it would be abolished. Green Party MP Sue Kedgley said it signaled the end of public broadcasting and that it was a sad day for New Zealand. But Broadcasting Minister Jonathan Coleman said there had not been much difference between TV New Zealand programming and other channels for a while. Mr. Coleman added the bill would free the company from the constraints of an unrealistic dual mandate and would allow it to effectively pursue commercial objectives. At the same time, TV New Zealand will have the flexibility it needs to effectively pursue commercial objectives and to continue its transition from a traditional broadcaster to a multi-platform digital media company with diverse income streams and services. TV New Zealand CEO Rick Ellis says while the legislation removes the charter from the Television New Zealand Act, it also provides confirmation of TV New Zealand's role as New Zealand's national television and digital media company. Mr. Ellis says the Act now specifies the functions of TV New Zealand are to be a successful television and digital media company, providing a range of content and services on a choice of delivery platforms, and maintain its commercial performance. In recent months, the French international TV service France 24 has experienced massive development in terms of distribution across Europe. In Northern Europe, France 24 has doubled its distribution in Finland following its launch on the country's two major cable offers. On the new offer resulting from the Welho and DNA merger, total of 630,000 subscribers, as well as on Eliza at 330,000 subscribers. Having obtained a license to broadcast on DTT in the Helsinki region, the English version of France 24 will be accessible in January of 2012. Further east in Russia, France 24 has met with success, concluding five new major contracts. The English version of the channel has been launched on three new IPTV operators, Rostelecom at 200,000 subscribers, Stream TV at 82,000 subscribers, and JSC TV, 20,000 subscribers, as well as on the mobile offer Beeline TV, including 400,000 3G subscribers, who can now access France 24 live 24/7. Finally, France 24 has signed an agreement with the Crystal TV Portal, a mobile TV application already downloaded by 1,750,000 users, mainly in Russia. The DRM Consortium will have its strongest presence ever at the International Convention, IBC, being held in Amsterdam from September 8th till 13th, 2011. IBC is considered the leading global trade show for professionals engaged in the creation, management, and delivery of broadcasting media and entertainment. In Amsterdam, DRM will be showcasing developments, highlighting the potential of the DRM standard, as well as presenting new receiver options. Three key consortium members, Transradio, Nautel, and Fraunhofer IIS, will host events on September 10th, 11th, and 12th, taking participants on a digital journey of discovery. On these 3 days, there will be updates on the latest market developments and demonstrations on how DRM, either as DRM 30 or as DRM Plus, can get multi-platform rich digital content direct to users. Videos and new receiver solutions will give these events a hands-on, unique feel. Ruxandra Abreja, DRM Consortium Chairman, says, "Our presence at IBC will show that DRM as a complete digital radio solution is very efficient and is making real progress in important global markets, which, in turn, is stimulating chipset and receiver manufacturers to develop new solutions and products." The BBC issued the following statement on July 13th. BBC Persian TV is again being jammed from within Iran. The deliberate interference began on Tuesday morning and is affecting the TV channel on the Hotbird satellite. Eutelsat, the satellite owner, have validated the geolocalization of the source of the interference as being in Iran. The BBC and Eutelsat condemn this deliberate interference that is clearly contrary to international conventions for the use of satellites. Eutelsat have confirmed that they will be submitting a new complaint to the French regulator, ANFR, for filing with the International Telecommunication Union, ITU. BBC Persian Television launched in 2009 and has suffered similar deliberate attempts to interfere with its signal intermittently ever since. And finally, an Egyptian court on July 11th ordered the state-owned satellite operator Nilesat to take 14 Libyan state channels off the air, the official MENA news agency reported. The Cairo Administrative Court ordered the channels off air after lawsuits filed by Libyan nationals and Egyptian lawyers who say the channels are being used by Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi to incite violence against rebels trying to overthrow him. The rebel leadership based in the eastern city of Benghazi has repeatedly accused Gaddafi of using state media as a weapon in the war that has left thousands dead. In June, NATO, which has been conducting airstrikes against Gaddafi's forces under a UN-mandated operation, denied that it had struck the country's state broadcaster in Tripoli, following an accusation by a Libyan Information Ministry official. Nilesat, which broadcasts more than 600 television channels, says that, as of 2009, it reached 40 million households. Special thanks goes to Andy Sennett at Radio Netherlands Worldwide for the stories used. If you wish to check out his blog for the latest developments, go to http://blogs.rnw.nl/media network/ or just go to www.pcjmedia.com and you will find a link to them there. I'm Paulette McQuarrie.
And you're listening to Media Network Plus. Going back to the days of the Second World War and the Cold War, BBC monitoring in Reading in the United Kingdom played a vital role to provide not just the BBC, but news organizations around the world with information on what was going on in some of the world's hotspots. Now, the Cold War may be over, but in more recent times, BBC monitoring has been listening to radio stations in places like Libya, Syria, North Korea, and others. Keith Somerville, who spent over 20 years at the BBC World Service, got his start in the 1980s at the Monitoring Service, monitoring broadcasts from Radio Moscow and others. He now tells us his unique story of the work done at BBC Monitoring.
Well, it was through one of the lesser-known bits of the BBC called the Monitoring Service, which is based out in this lovely old stately home just outside Reading, west of London. And it was set up during the war to monitor foreign radio broadcasts, both for news for the BBC, but it also provided then and indeed now information to, say, the Foreign Office, Ministry of Defence, Cabinet Office on what is being said by the foreign media in relation to major political events of the day. So I started there, oh my God, in 1980, when I'd been carrying out research. My background is originally as an academic, carrying out research on relations between the Soviet Union and liberation movements in Southern Africa. And while I was carrying out that research, a job was advertised at the monitoring service, specifically looking for people who had a knowledge of what the Soviet Union was saying to the rest of the world about its system and also about world events. So I moved to monitoring, did a couple of years there monitoring a huge range of foreign broadcasts, particularly Moscow radio in English around the world and to Africa.
If back in those days I'd walked into the BBC monitoring service, which I'm familiar with, what I've seen just rows and rows of people listening with headsets and tape recorders recording stuff on air?
Yes, pretty well. We would listen to set broadcasts. We knew which broadcasts were going where, because obviously the broadcasters wanted an audience, so they would tell people when they were broadcasting. And over time, we would monitor the main broadcasts, and you would get a picture of which are the ones that tended to have breaking news in it, which are the ones from the Soviet Union that would be addressing particular issues. So you would have where I sat as you went into what was known as the listening room. On your right as you went in were the monitors who monitored in English. And in some ways, we had the most interesting job because we monitored the widest range of stations. Opposite us were the Spanish team who would monitor Madrid radio, but also Moscow in Spanish. There were the Portuguese monitors who would monitor Lisbon and Moscow in Portuguese. Czech monitors who would listen to Prague and to Bratislava and to Moscow in Czech. So each team would do its own country plus Moscow's bulletins in that language. And then at the end of the room, you had the huge Russian team, which did Moscow and other domestic radio stations in Russian. So we would all listen. You'd hear something. If it was newsworthy, you hammered it out on old typewriters and rushed into the newsroom with it. If it was more of a propaganda piece, you would probably type it out in full and it would later be published.
You're going to laugh at this, but a friend of mine who used to work at Radio Moscow by the name of Vasily Strelnikov, he hosted a show for years called Vasily's Weekend. And when he started off, he used to read news, and he said back in those days, the news at Radio Moscow was a certain time, but he read faster than other announcers at Radio Moscow. So the plan was if you were short of material, you'd have to take one of the stories that you did in the last bulletin. And he said over a 5-hour period, he read this one literary story every hour and on the bottom of every hour. And he said all of a sudden on the BBC World Service, they reported on it for some strange activity going on with a literary fair in Moscow.
Yeah, I mean, that's the sort of thing we would do. I was on the night before Brezhnev died. And it was most annoying because I finished my shift at about 2 a.m, at which time Moscow Radio, domestic and foreign, had cut off a lot of its lighter programs and was playing a lot of solemn music. And we thought, Brezhnev is dead. But I went home, went to bed, and it was only when I woke up at about 10 the next morning that I actually found out, yes, he was. So we would watch Moscow behavior and other stations' behavior very closely to try and think, is there a change in the behavior? Because with societies where they perhaps weren't as immediately open, you would look for little changes to see if that told you something.
Well, I mean, that's pretty much the case with places like North Korea and maybe China 15, 20 years ago.
Oh, yeah. And one of the jobs I moved on to, at first I monitored in English, and then I spent about 9 months out in Southern Africa, based in Malawi, monitoring radio stations around Southern Africa. When I came back, I moved into the publication side, editing things that had been monitored. And for 6 months, I worked on Chinese and North Korean stuff. And it was just quite amazing. You would go through, you know, 30 pages of one North Korean speech trying to pick out something that was different.
You know, recently I spoke to someone who was very familiar with radio, the Voice of Korea from the DPRK, and he said, 30 years ago, if you listen to them, they sound exactly the same way as they do now.
That's the impression I get. That most other places have changed. Russia's broadcasting is now totally different. But North Korea, I think, is exactly the same. You've hit the nail on the head.
And that was Keith Somerville, formerly of BBC Monitoring in Reading.
Media Network Plus.
Just before recording this program, we just got a notification that Dutch-based radio station Radio De Banga, which broadcasted the Darfur region, will have a revised schedule beginning Monday, the 18th of July. Well, here it is. Their broadcasts at 4:30 UTC to 5:57 UTC will be using the following frequencies: 15550 kilohertz, 13620 kilohertz, 13730 kilohertz. And from 15:29 UTC to 16:27 UTC on 15720 kilohertz and 13730 kilohertz. And we know that even though outside the Darfur region, there are those who live in other areas enjoy tuning in as well. Okay, now time to pretend we're somebody we're not. Well, there are people out there like that. But we're going to pretend we're James Bond, you and I, okay? So, we have all our spy gear. You know, our Major Decoder ring, our pen that can launch missiles, our watch that can, blow up tanks. Special sunglasses that can see through people's bodies. Something that they have at certain airports in the US, by the way. Anyway, we have all our spy gear, including a very simple radio. And we're in some exotic location. Let's think of someplace. Barbados. Yeah, Barbados, Hawaii, somewhere in the beautiful South Pacific. So we turn our radio on, and we're waiting for a special message from Miss Moneypenny. And this is what we hear. Well, it seems like Miss Moneypenny is now speaking Chinese. Anyway, that's the infamous Chinese language spy number station, New Star Broadcasting. Well, for as long as radio has been around, these stations have been popping up on the air from time to time. Now, today there's not as many as there were, let's say, during the Cold War, but a number of them remain on the air today, like that one. Now, this station broadcasts a number of times every day on many different frequencies, but the best ones to try are at 05, 06, and 07 UTC on 9,725 kilohertz, and they broadcast for 30 minutes. Well, recently, American journalist Wendell Minnick, who works as the Taiwan-based correspondent for Defense Weekly News, decided to look into this unique station, and we caught up with him.
Number stations had largely been forgotten for a long time because the Cold War was over, and I happened upon a recording on YouTube about some Chinese number stations, and purely by accident, you know, just spooking around the YouTube, looking at things, and found them, and I realized it was a local guy here that recorded it, and I contacted him and did a story.
Now, when you're doing a story on this kind of station, what are the challenges and hoops that you have to go through? Because it's not like an intelligence agency will say, oh, yeah, we have a radio station.
Well, yeah, obviously the U.S. intelligence or even the Taiwan intelligence is not going to admit to broadcasting numbers. For one thing, a lot of the folks in the intelligence community here in the Taiwan government didn't know what the hell I was talking about when I did ask about the number stations, and it took a lot of digging to finally get someone to acknowledge that they were doing something in that order. But they also admitted that they weren't sure that the numbers that I'd recorded or and played back for them were the same numbers that they're broadcasting. So It's a very compartmentalized system. So, but yeah, the technical issues were a big problem. Just because of broadcasting numbers doesn't mean they're necessarily spies. I went through a whole host of scenarios. One was fishing boats. We thought maybe that the numbers were being broadcast to fishing boats at sea so that they could, you know, strategize on fishing areas, you know, so that the other fishing boats wouldn't know which areas that they were going to fish next. That was killed. That idea was killed.
And then there was Chinese telegraphy.
Yeah, telegraphy was another issue because the Chinese characters, there's so many of them that the numbers represent characters. Like, you know, A is 1, B is 2, C is 3 in the English alphabet. Well, Chinese characters, there are thousands of them. So they assign a four-digit number to each character. So we assumed it, and they call it the Chinese telegraph code, and we thought that that might be what it is. But the numbers broadcast we got the Chinese telegraph code, and it didn't match the numbers at all. And we got three different kinds of Chinese telegraph code, the Hong Kong, Taiwanese, and the mainland Chinese telegraph code, and the numbers didn't match. My wife actually transcribed this stuff, matched it up, and said that they didn't. That was a hard job, actually, writing down each number and looking up the Chinese telegraph code. It took a lot of time. It took about a month to write the story.
When you were working on the story, were there any strange things that happened, like maybe people trying to put you off from even talking about it?
I think there were a lot of people who just didn't believe it was still going on, because it's an old Cold War trick. And we have the internet now, and people were saying things like, why would they broadcast numbers when they could simply place a coded message on, let's say, an advertisement, a fake advertisement somewhere, or a fake website, or a blog, and someone could just look it up and get the numbers off there, or get the code off there, or whatever. But that still traces you back to the site. You know, if I get on that site from my home computer, people know that I got on that site. Even if it's a front, or some sort of blog, or something, the chance of being caught are serious. So, and the other issue is that during a war, they might shut down the internet. The internet might not be working anymore, so the best way to broadcast would be shortwave, which can't be shut down, really.
So when you were researching it and you met government officials, did you meet people, let's say, from the Ministry of Defense and other departments? And what did they say to you? Did they, like, look around at each other going, oh, I think we're caught, or did they try to uncomfortably laugh it off?
There were a lot of puzzled looks. You know, I had to really get the Ministry of National Defense to really dig into it themselves, because they weren't sure what the hell I was talking about, and I had to play it back for them. They finally came back and said that, yeah, that it was a number station, and they were aware of it. They did acknowledge that it did exist, but whether it belonged to the Taiwanese or the mainland Chinese is not clear. I did also attend a meeting with the local Taipei Amateur Radio Club and got their impressions of the broadcast, and they were very positive that it wasn't a fake. They, you know, that's one of the questions I posed is, are these numbers being broadcast by some kid in the basement, you know, with his own antenna on the roof? And then they came back adamantly, repeatedly saying no, that these had to be broadcast by a larger transmitter or something that the government would have. So that was one issue I was concerned about, that it was a fake broadcast.
Now, you write for Defense Weekly News, and you have a lot of interest in these spy stories. I mean, they are very interesting. And there was another place, actually, that people around the world may not know about. It's a place here in Taiwan called Spook Mountain. What is the story with Spook Mountain?
The Signal Intelligence Facility in Yamishan is run jointly by the U.S. National Security Agency and the Taiwanese National Security Bureau. And they monitor Chinese mainland radio traffic. And that facility has been there for about 12 years now. There was one in Hong Kong many years ago during the Cold War, and when that shut down before 97, they just moved it here to pick up the transmissions. They couldn't maintain it in Hong Kong for obvious reasons. So the facility is run here, and I actually, when I first came here in 97, I was hanging out in a bar, and I ran into some American technicians who were claiming they worked for the phone company. And then they were drunk, and then as they got more and more drunk, they talk about being CIA agents to these little girls behind the bar, obviously trying to impress them. But obviously they weren't working for the CIA; they were just technicians working on contract for the National Security Agency and the Taiwanese. But you know, I drank with them a lot, hung out with them a lot, and I got to know them. And after a while, it just came out. I slowly began to put the pieces together. from different ones, from different points, and I finally went up there and photographed the facility, and I did a huge story about it. You know, it was very embarrassing to the U.S. And the Taiwan government. So,
now, when you're doing this kind of story here in Taiwan, and you're covering this topic, has it ever happened to you that they will call you and say, we'd rather you kill this story, we'd rather you not report on it? Have you ever received that kind of pressure? And in China, for example, foreign reporters will get this pressure from the Chinese government. What about here in Taiwan?
I never receive pressure from the Taiwan government or the U.S. government not to do a story. They never contact me and say, you kill this thing. I've approached the folks here in the Taiwan intelligence service and military about stories I'm writing, just to give them a chance to be aware that, you know, they have to respond to the idea that I'm doing a story in the first place. But they've never asked me to not to do this story or threaten me or anything like that. And the U.S. doesn't really has a policy of not talking about intelligence operations like that. So
here's another question. I mean, I don't know how much you would know about it, but during the Cold War, West Berlin was known for the spies that were running around West Berlin. Here in Taiwan, during, let's say, the 60s, 70s, and 80s, was this place overrun with spies, let's say, like West Germany was, or West Berlin?
Well, not from China, that's for sure. Right. Most of the spies that came in from China later came when direct contact with the Chinese mainland became more and more open, and that was in the 1990s, and up to now, it's becoming even more open. They have direct flights now back and forth from the mainland, and so interaction, the more interaction you have, the more chance you have for spies. But I would say that Taiwan's military and government is just full of spies, mainland Chinese spies, so they probably pretty much know everything that's going on here.
And I was speaking there with the Taiwan correspondent for Defense Weekly News, Wendell Minnick, about new star broadcasting. Makes me wonder if I should have a different career. Anyway, with that, we've come to the end of this week's edition of Media Network Plus. If you want to find out our past programs or get more information, just go to our website, www.pcjmedia.com. That's www.pcjmedia.com. Of course, you can always email us with your suggestions and comments. Our email address is very simply MNP, which stands for Media Network Plus, at pcjmedia.com. That's MNP at pcjmedia.com. So on behalf of the entire team, this is Keith Perron saying so long, take care. 73s to you all and 88s to the ladies.